Hello, and welcome to Ox Talk for Tuesday, the 3rd of October 2023. My name is Guy, and I've compiled the edition for this week. News items have been selected from local Oxford papers by Leslie Court and Diane Sider, and recorded at home by Leslie Court and Jill Jones. The USBs have been copied and distributed by Michelle Lawful. Sunrise today is at 7:08 a.m. and sunset is at 6:38 p.m. Before the news, we mark some events which happened on October the 3rd in history. In 1995, the trial of O.J. Simpson ended with a not guilty verdict on the charge of murdering his ex-wife Nicole Brown Simpson and her friend Ronald Goulburn. In 1990, Germany was reunified after 4 decades of the Cold War. In 1959, postcodes were first introduced into Britain. In 1283, Dafydd ap Gruffydd, Prince of Gwynedd and the last independent ruler of Wales, became the first nobleman to be executed by being hanged, drawn and quartered. This for the plotting of the death of King Edward I. Born on this day, in 1951, was Catherine Sullivan, an American oceanographer and astronaut, who in 1984 became the first American woman to walk in space. In 1938, Eddie Cochran was born, American singer and musician who died at the age of 21 in a car crash near Chippenham in Wiltshire while on tour in England. In 1925, Gore Vidal was born, prolific American writer, well known for his outspoken political opinions and witty and satirical observations on life. In 1916, James Herriot was born, British veterinarian and writer who, at the age of 50, was persuaded by his wife to write down his collection of veterinary anecdotes in If Only They Could Talk, in 1970, and It Shouldn't Happen to a Vet, in 1972. The books were issued in the US as All Creatures Great and Small. And deaths on this day. In 2005, Ronnie Barker, English comedian and actor, star of the Two Ronnies sketch show with Ronnie Corbett, Porridge, Open All Hours, and much more. In 1967, Sir Malcolm Sargent, English conductor, self-styled ambassador of music, who took charge of London's Promenade Concerts, also known as the Proms, from 1947 until his death. In 1896, William Morris, English designer, craftsman, poet, and early socialist, his style generated the arts and crafts movement in England and revolutionised Victorian tastes. In 1226, St. Francis of Assisi, Italian saint who founded the Franciscan order, amongst others, he was canonised less than 2 years after his death. Now, on to the news. We hope you enjoy our selection of articles for this week.
BMW has applied to make major changes to the Oxford Mini plant following its announcement of a multi-million pound investment into electric car production. The company was lauded by councillors and politicians, including the Prime Minister, earlier this month, when it revealed plans to pump £600 million into mini factories in Oxford and Swindon, with ambitions to transform the plant in Cowley to all-electric production by 2030. It has now applied to Oxford City Council to increase operations at the Cowley site by building a new trailer park and making changes to an existing logistics centre. In an application on the Council's planning website, BMW said that the changes would streamline processes for car delivery and enhance the existing systems. The Oxford Mini plant already produces the Mini 3-door, the Mini 5-door, as well as the Mini Clubman and the Mini Electric. From next year, the plant will start producing the next generation Mini 3-door and Mini 5-door with combustion engines, as well as the new Mini Convertible. And from 2026, two new all-electric Mini models will be built at the plant. BMW claims the investment will secure more than 4,000 jobs. Following the announcement earlier this month, Stephanie Wurst, head of the Mini brand, said, "Mini has always been aware of its history. Oxford is and remains at the heart of the brand."
Nearly a third of patients admitted to hospital with COVID-19 had abnormalities in multiple organs 5 months after their infection, an Oxford study found. MRI scans of patients in the study, which is led by researchers from the University of Oxford, showed more abnormal findings involving the lungs, brain and kidneys compared to a group of people who had not had the virus. Betty Raman, Associate Professor of Cardiovascular Medicine at the University of Oxford, said, "We found that nearly one in three patients had an excess burden of multi-organ abnormalities on MRI relative to controls. At 5 months after hospital discharge for COVID-19, patients showed a high burden of abnormalities involving the lungs, brain and kidneys compared to our non-COVID-19 controls. The age of the individual, severity of acute COVID-19 infection, as well as comorbidities, were significant factors in determining who had organ injury at follow-up." Dr. Raman said people who had been suffering with long COVID should feel hopeful that the research was ongoing and that there were some answers. Researchers compared scans from 259 patients who had been treated for COVID in hospital with a control group of 52 people who did not have the virus. The study was published in The Lancet Respiratory Medicine.
A nurse has scaled the highest mountain in England and Wales at night to raise money for a hospice in South Oxfordshire. Livy Rowe, 23, from Benson, participated in the Yrwyddfa Snowdon by Night challenge for the Sue Ryder Palliative Care Hub. She works as a bank nursing assistant at the hub while studying medicine on an accelerated degree programme at Southampton University. The hub provides hospice care for life-limiting conditions to help patients manage pain and offer emotional, practical and spiritual support. She described the walk as really tough towards the end, with horizontal rain and tiredness being a notable feature of the journey. "Reduced visibility made the climb back down surprisingly hard," Mrs. Rowe said. She added, "On the evening of the hike, we met everyone who was joining. There were so many people hiking for Sue Ryder, it made it feel really special. I can honestly say that at no point did I think I can't do this. And I think that's down to why I decided to do the hike, and also seeing such a big group of people supporting Sue Ryder from across the country come together, determined to complete it." The hike came to an end after 6 hours when Ms. Rowe finally reached the bottom of the mountain at 4 a.m. Ms. Rowe has so far raised almost £800 for her climb.
Many firefighters in Oxfordshire have completely lost faith in their senior leadership team, claims an insider who has broken ranks to reveal the rifts within the county's fire service. The firefighter, who asked to remain anonymous over fears for his job security, alleged that the safety of frontline firefighters in Oxfordshire Fire and Rescue Service had been forgotten, and raised concerns over potential plans to sell a fire station in Oxford to developers. "As a firefighter for Oxfordshire Fire and Rescue, I and many other firefighters have completely lost faith in our chief and our senior leadership team," said the firefighter, whose identity has been confirmed by the Oxford Mail. "This is due to him forgetting about the firefighters on the front line and bringing in changes that have had a detrimental impact on the service." In response to the criticism, Chief Fire Officer Rob McDougall said, "We are committed to protecting the firefighters who protect our communities." One claim made by the firefighter is that the service's participation in the direct entry scheme, which sees some station managers recruited without fire service experience, has made for a weaker workforce. There is one recruit from the scheme in post in Oxfordshire. Mr. McDougall defended the scheme and claimed the 3-year training programme gave recruits appropriate operational competence. He added that a more traditional station manager process, open only to existing fire and rescue officers, will remain the mainstay of our leadership succession. But Mr. McDougall's ideas were dismissed as quite frankly inadequate by the firefighter, who pointed to the proposed redevelopment of Rewley Road Fire Station as an example. The plans, which are at an early stage, would see the three-bay fire station reduced to a two-bay one, with the remaining areas developed for other uses. The firefighter claimed this would reduce the fire cover to Oxford and the people of Oxfordshire. As firefighters, we want this to be a positive move towards building a future-proof station and training facility, they said. However, as mentioned, we've lost faith in the senior leadership team and don't believe they will put the firefighter first. In response, Mr. McDougall said, any proposals will ensure we maintain our average response times across Oxford and we will consult with the public as part of this process. Another concern raised by the firefighter was over a lack of action towards decontamination in the fire service, and they said any money from the proposed sale of the Rewley Road site should be partly invested into new decontamination facilities. They said he, Mr. McDougall, has done nothing towards making firefighting safer in the sense of decontamination. Mr. McDougall said procedures were in place to mitigate the impact of residual fire contaminants and the service was improving washing and shower facilities across its stations.
A new shop selling crystals is opening at Oxford's Covered Market. Retailers say that crystals have been used for their healing and spiritual properties for thousands of years, and they continue to be popular. The natural beauty of stones and crystals also makes them fun to collect or give as gifts, traders say. After years running a children's disco business, Sarah Jane Nichols needed a change of pace due to health issues. She found herself helping out at her mother's crystal shop, Crystal Spirit, in Swindon, and it was there that she fell in love with the trade. Together with her mum, the idea for the Crystal Spirit Emporium was born. Mrs. Nichols said, my mum has a shop in Swindon which is called Crystal Spirit. She's been selling crystals for about 20 years, so I have lots of experience from working with her. I'm a really good salesperson and I love people and I love crystals, so I thought it would just be a good idea to open up my shop. Oxford is somewhere I love and the Covered Market is just the most amazing place ever. Graham MacDonald, who runs the chocolate shop at the market entrance, encouraged me to get in touch and ask about any empty units. I sent off my business plan, and here we are. Mrs. Nichols said crystals were dug up from various locations around the globe. The rock is cut up, and the pieces are moulded into shapes, she added. There are also natural pieces that are sold directly without being moulded. Mrs. Nichols said that the crystals in the shop range in price from 50p to more than £1,000. An amethyst church could cost £1,000 or more. Sometimes they cost less. There are mini ones that cost £60. I have one in the corner of my room and it's stunning. It looks amazing. A lot of people find amethyst to be a calming crystal. We never guarantee the effect a crystal will have, but people did use crystals in ancient times. The trader said having the sign created above the shop has really made her dream feel real. The windows are blacked out right now for the big reveal on Saturday. As well as a huge variety of crystals, the Crystal Spirit Emporium will be introducing lucky dips. They've been very popular attraction at her mum's shops and are perfect for that early Christmas stocking filler. Mrs. Nichols added, whether you believe in crystals or not, they're very beautiful, so we hope everybody will find something to enjoy in our shop. In addition to the crystals, there will also be a fairy garden, two water features, fairy treasure and pictures. The shop will open at 10 a.m. on Saturday and will then be open from 10 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. Monday to Saturday and from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Sundays.
Oxford house prices increased more than the average for the South East in July, new figures show. House prices in Oxford rose by 3.6% in July, an increase that contributes to the longer-term trend, which has seen property prices in the area grow by 6.5% over the last year. The average Oxford house price in July was £498,231, Land Registry figures show, an increase on June. Over the month, the picture was different from that across the southeast, where prices increased 0.5% and Oxford was above the 0.5% rise for the UK as a whole. Over the last year, the average sale price of property in Oxford rose by £30,000, putting the area third among the southeast's 64 local authorities with price data for annual growth. The highest annual growth in the region was in West Oxfordshire, where property prices increased on average by 7% to £403,000. First-time buyers in Oxford spent an average of £436,000 on their property, £25,000 more than a year ago, and £67,000 more than in July 2018. By comparison, former owner-occupiers paid £557,000 on average in July, 27.9% more than first-time buyers. Owners of detached houses saw the biggest rise in property prices in Oxford in July. They increased 3.8% to 1,040,083 pounds on average. Over the last year, prices rose by 7.9%.
More than 26,000 homes are needed in Oxford by 2040, but the city only has the capacity for around 9,500 of these. New figures from the Oxford City Council reveal that Oxford will need 26,440 homes by 2040, which means that 1,322 would need to be built per year. However, there is only capacity to build 9,612 of these, 481 a year within the city's boundaries. This means the shortfall between need and capacity within Oxford's boundaries means an unmet need of 16,828 homes before 2040, 841 a year. Oxford's neighbouring districts have already agreed to accommodate 14,300 of these, 715 homes a year, on sites bordering or close to the city. To accommodate the additional 2,528 homes will only require 126 extra homes each year across Oxfordshire until 2040. Councillor Louise Upton, Cabinet Minister for Planning and Healthier Communities, said, "We have robust and objective evidence on how many more homes Oxford will need before 2040. We have worked hard to maximise the capacity for building those new homes within our city. I would also stress that we have not allocated any new sites for employment in our next local plan, and we've made it easier for large employers to build affordable housing for workers on their own land, or even for that land to be converted to residential use. The City Council have created the housing company Ox Place to build homes in difficult-to-develop sites within Oxford. Ox Place aims to build 2,000 homes over the next decade." Councillor Upton said, "We also assume a housing density generally of double that of our neighbouring districts, and we're making the best use of the City Council's own land with our housing company Ox Place, unlocking the potential of brownfield and small infill sites that purely commercial developers would not consider viable. We appreciate that asking our neighbouring districts to allow extra homes within their boundaries is not easy, but our new plan to 2040 only asks for an extra 126 homes a year across the whole county to meet Oxford's unmet need. We think many of these could be delivered on sites already allocated for development in their current local plan." Oxford's draft local plan is underpinned by two main documents. Firstly, the Independent Housing and Employment Needs Assessment, HENA, This has been jointly commissioned with Charwell District Council, and it assesses the need for housing based on forecasts of economic growth by forecasting future job growth and then calculating the number of homes needed to support this sustainably. Its purpose is to specifically inform the review of both Oxford and Charwell local plans. The second document is a separate Housing and Economic Land Availability Assessment, HELAA. For this, the council searches the city for all possible potential sites where the landowner is willing to bring the land forward for housing. The city council will use its evidence as the basis for discussions with its local surrounding districts on meeting Oxford's unmet needs whilst developing their local plans. Oxford's draft local plan 2040 will go out for public consultation in October.
A tree planting ceremony has marked the end of structural work on two buildings at Begbroke Science Park. The buildings are expected to be handed over by construction firm Mace early next year, providing 12,500 square metres of office and lab space. Once complete, they will almost double the Science Park's usable internal space. One will be occupied by academics from the University of Oxford, while the other will house private sector researchers. University Vice Chancellor Irene Tracy helped plant a black tupelo tree at the site, marking the construction milestone. Professor Tracy said, "These two new buildings will provide a fantastic new setting for science, collaboration and knowledge sharing, creating new jobs and supporting the growth of Oxford's flourishing innovation economy." But her comments came as Oxford was expected to be pipped by Cambridge in the world rankings of top science and technology clusters.
A brass band organisation in Wantage will mark its 51st anniversary with a fair-style celebration next month. Wantage Silver Band will host the event on October the 7th at its premises on Tugwell Field, with live music, games and refreshments throughout the day. Founded in 1972, the band is recognised as one of the largest brass band organisations in the UK. A half-centennial celebration was held last year, and the success of the event encouraged the organisation to continue it as a newfound tradition. This year's event will also mark the opening of the Sykes Hall, its second band hall. Chair of Trustees Eleanor Turner said, "It was a day we've been excited about for some time. This is a great fundraiser for the band, and it will be a brilliant chance for the community to see our new hall and hear many of our bands and their fantastic music," she continued. "A huge thank you to everyone who has dedicated their time and donated generously to help with its success." Starting at noon, the celebration will see performances from 8 of the 9 bands that make up the organisation. There will also be a tombola and a raffle, games and a bar, all run by volunteers in the organisation's 200-plus membership. Shortly before the event finishes at 7 p.m, Town Mayor Angela Dunsford will present the annual awards, which recognise members and supporters who have gone above and beyond for the organisation. For more information, visit www.wantageband.org.
Oxfordshire children's reading, writing and maths abilities are worse than before the pandemic, new figures show. The latest Department for Education figures show 59% of 7,732 eligible pupils in Oxfordshire met the expected standard in reading, writing and maths in Key Stage 2 in the 2022-23 school year. This was up slightly from 58% the year before, but remained below pre-pandemic levels. In 2018-19, 65% met the expected standard. Across England, children's attainment in key subjects remains significantly worse than before 3 successive lockdowns in 2020 and 2021. The Association of School and College Leaders said schools are working hard to improve results, but they're hamstrung by the government's inadequate educational recovery programme. Nationally, just 59% of pupils reached the expected standard in reading, writing and maths in 2022-3, unchanged from 2021-2, but still well below 65% in 2018-19. The government aims for 90% of Key Stage 2 children to meet the expected standard in reading, writing and maths. No area in the country is above 75%. Tiffany Harris, primary and data specialist at the ASCL, said the results clearly show schools are still feeling the pandemic's effect on education. She said schools are doing everything they can to improve results, but have been hamstrung by the government's inadequate education recovery programme following the pandemic. Primary schools are also suffering from a lack of funding, as well as teacher shortages that are having an impact across the education sector. It is very difficult to raise standards under these circumstances. The figures also show the gap between disadvantaged children and their classmates shrank, with the proportion of disadvantaged children reaching the expected attainment across reading, writing and maths rising slightly from 43% to 44%. Meanwhile, special education needs pupils also saw a rise in their attainment, with 20% reaching the expected standard, up from 18% the year before. The Department for Education said its mission is to make sure every child has a world-class start in life. It's great to see an increase in the proportion of disadvantaged pupils and those with SEN meeting the expected standard in reading, writing and maths, a spokesperson said. We have been relentlessly focused on closing the gap between disadvantaged pupils and their peers, and we continue to fund our flagship national tutoring programme to help young people make up for time lost during the pandemic. We also continue to drive up standards, as demonstrated by England coming fourth out of 43 countries that tested children of the same age in the PIRLS International Survey of the Reading Ability of 9 and 10-year-olds, they added.
Dog owners have been warned to be on the lookout for grass seeds while walking their pets after one pooch almost died. Archie, a 15-month-old Cocker Spaniel, needed major surgery to save his life after breathing in grass seeds. Owner Letitia Carter feared she may lose her beloved hound before a team at the hospital carried out the delicate 2-hour procedure. Now, after vets say the soggy summer has led them to seeing a surge in grass seed cases, Letitia is backing calls for other owners to be aware of the potential dangers. Archie is usually full of energy, but he was really off and wasn't eating or drinking, said Letitia from Chipping Norton. We had no idea what was causing it, but his breathing became laboured and he looked so unwell one evening we knew we had to get some help. He couldn't really stand up and I was so worried that I drove him straight to the hospital. Archie was given an X-ray and CT scans, which showed that he had a collapsed lung and 2 abscesses, containing a total of 4 seeds in his chest cavity. The chances of these seeds not causing catastrophic complications was virtually nil, so surgery was required, said Dr. Peter Kettlewell, clinical director at Chipping Norton Veterinary Hospital, part of My Family Vets. These seeds could have been breathed in days or even weeks before. Although we see many problems caused by grass seeds every summer, we're having a particularly bad season this year. We have seen a lot of dogs with grass seeds, not just in their paws and ears, but also inhaled. They can be really dangerous, and dogs that sniff the grass heavily, like spaniels, are particularly prone to problems. Thankfully, the major operation, which involved fully opening Archie's chest, was a success, and he was allowed home again within 72 hours. He's bouncy and happy again, and we are just so grateful to everyone at the hospital for all they did, said Letitia. I had absolutely no idea of the dangers before, but now I've seen these arrowhead grass seeds everywhere. I've really been thinking through where we take him on walks. I've been taking him to more woodland areas where there's not such dense grass and lots of seeds. It was really worrying, and I have been trying to make as many people as possible aware of what can happen.
A police officer who went to hospital after friends said he looked like he'd been on a three-day bender was found to have an aggressive brain tumour. PC Jack Watts, who'd been suffering from pressure headaches, was transferred to Oxford's John Radcliffe Hospital by ambulance, having first gone to his local hospital in Kettering, North Ants, telling girlfriend Charlotte Patch not to worry. Doctors in Oxford were shocked to discover he had an aggressive brain tumour, which could not be operated on due to its dangerous location in the police officer's head. Medics concluded the tumour was so aggressive they were only able to carry out 3 weeks of chemo and radiotherapy before running out of treatment options. Unhappy with the prognosis, Jack and Charlotte discovered a clinic in Germany able to provide rounds of immunotherapy. With the help of best friend Ben Hanger, the couple are now making the 1,200-mile round trip to the Halvan Clinic in Dornstetten every 3 weeks so Jack can receive the treatment. Each round of immunotherapy costs around £26,000. The couple have managed to raise £120,000 through online donation site JustGiving, but will need more to keep paying for Jack's treatment past the end of October. Charlotte told PA, "Our whole life has been completely kicked upside down." Partner Jack began experiencing migraines for the first time in February this year and found that he was struggling to see his computer screen at work clearly. He visited the opticians to be told what he already knew. He had a lazy left eye. A few weeks later, Jack was spotted by one of his best friends walking along the road to his parents' house in Kettering, looking out of sorts. "It looked like he'd been on a three-day bender," said Charlotte. "He was almost walking sideways." Jack visited Kettering General Hospital, telling his partner not to worry and that he'd be back shortly. Concerned, doctors transferred him by ambulance to the JR, Oxford. Doctors in the city were shocked to discover that he had this aggressive brain tumour. Unable to operate because of the dangerous location of the tumour, they inserted a fluid pathway into his brain. Charlotte said, "We had to wait about 2 weeks, and then they said it's glioblastoma. It's stage 4. It's as bad as it can physically be, and they can't operate on it because of where it is." Jack began 6 weeks of chemo and radiotherapy, but the treatment had to be cut short as the cancer had progressed. He said, "My tumour is a little different because it's growing in the middle of my brain, so they could only do 3 weeks of chemo and radiotherapy." Told that was all they could give Jack, the couple began doing their own research online and found out about a clinic in Germany that might be able to help. Jack said they'll basically try when nobody in England will. "We know the situation is terrible, but we need someone to just try. That's why we went with Germany, because the clinic will just keep going, provided the money keeps coming." He is currently receiving 3 different types of immunotherapy and is waiting to undergo gene testing so that doctors can pinpoint exactly what treatment is most likely to be successful. Almost 20,000 people have already donated to Jack's treatment fund, but the cash will run out in October. To support Jack and Charlotte, visit www.justgiving.com/crowdfunding/Jack's-life-fund.
A foodies pub in North Oxford is the subject of discussions about community ownership. The Anchor in Hayfield Road is owned by Wadworth and has seasonal menus, Wadworth beers and a large wine selection. It features one of the largest heated pub gardens in Oxford with a cosy snug area. Residents of Hayfield Road held a meeting last Wednesday to discuss the possibility of making a bid for community ownership, as they understand that the current management may be considering moving. There are a number of community-owned pubs across Oxfordshire, including the Lamb and Flag in St Giles and the White Hart in Wolvercote. A resident said, "The Anchor has been part of the landscape for many years and is much loved, but the current leaseholder may be moving on, and we feel its future may be in a slightly different offering that works for this area as it is changing. We are thinking about what it might look like and whether that is a thing that might be of interest to Wadworth, which owns the site. We are intending to sound out Wadworth on this in the next few days." The management at the Anchor has not yet commented. Community ownership has saved some pubs from closing. the Lamb and Flag in St Giles, owned by St John's College, shut suddenly in the pandemic as it wasn't making enough money. But a community interest group called the Inklings stepped in to run the pub, and it reopened last year. And the White Hart in Wolvercote has been a community-run pub for about 10 years. In 2013, the White Hart Community Pub Limited was set up by Wolvercote residents to run the White Hart as a community hub. Dave Richardson, a spokesman for Oxford Camra, the campaign for real ale, said, "The Anchor is owned by Wadsworth Brewery, but if it decides to sell it, then local people will be in a stronger position if they can get an asset of community value order in place now. I would think its future as a pub is secure, whoever runs it. Community ownership is now established at 10 pubs in Oxfordshire, and while it works best in a village setting, there's no reason why it couldn't work in North Oxford, and there's plenty of advice on the Camra website. But other pub groups could be interested too." Following the meeting, residents have been discussing the process of how to go about launching a bid for community ownership, how to fundraise, and the potential costs involved.
Plans to rename an Oxford college after a Vietnamese airline owner have been dropped, according to reports. Lineker College unveiled plans to change its name in 2021 after company Sovico Group promised a £155 million donation. The Oxford institution said it would be known as Tao College after Sovico's chairwoman Nguyen T. Phuong Tao. The businesswoman founded budget airline Vietjet, which in 2012 hit the headlines after its staff flights with bikini-clad attendants. But the plans to rename the college in honour of Southeast Asia's first female billionaire proved controversial with alumni and politicians. Now, according to reports in The Telegraph, the college is no longer expecting to receive the multi-million pound donation. Restrictions on outward donation, imposed by the Vietnamese government, were blamed, alumni were reportedly told earlier this month. Lineker College and the University of Oxford have not commented on the reports. In its annual report for the financial year 2021-2, received by the Charity Commission in January 2023, the college said it had signed a Memorandum of Understanding on October 31, 2021, confirming plans to progress a donation totalling £155 million. It included £100 million to buy and develop a major second site for the college in central Oxford. Plans were developing with the donor and would be reported as soon as this is possible, the college wrote in its annual report. In November 2021, days after the Memorandum of Understanding was signed with Sovico that it would have to approach the Privy Council to ask permission to change its name to Tao College, following the first gift of £50 million. But last year it was reported that first donation had not been made months after an agreed deadline at the end of June 2022. That month, June, the college defended its handling of the £155 million donation after concerns were raised in the House of Commons over its Memorandum of Understanding with Sovico, with MPs alleging close links between Ms. Tao's firm and Vietnam's communist government. Education Minister Michelle Donnellan told MPs she was actively investigating the matter. The Department for Education later said it was reassured by the college's due diligence, it was said. Head of Development at the college, Lisa Smars, accepted that some had been disheartened by news of the proposed renaming. But she added in her letter, posted on the college's website, "I truly think that we're doing what is right for the college." Ms. Smars reassured former students, "Having spent time with Madam Tao, I know that she is very supportive of us and what we represent, and that she is not in any way looking to change our spirit or values."
People with mobility issues have shared their frustration about a broken lift, which stops them from easily attending classes and a cafe in a sports centre. The broken lift in Whitelands Farm Sports Ground, which leads upstairs to the Oxford Farm Kitchen Cafe and a number of higher rooms, has become a problem for certain demographics of people in Bicester. Retired teaching assistant Fran Portlock, who has lived in Bicester since 1985, said, "The lift has been out for about 9 months. It has worked for one day in total since I've been visiting the cafe. Some of my friends with mobility issues simply can't join my husband and I in the cafe because they can't get up the stairs. I know this is also causing problems for people with buggies and prams." Mrs. Portlock is involved with an over-60s club that meets every Tuesday in the Shakespeare pub to do bingo, quizzes and other activities. After their pub meet-up, the group will often head to the Whitelands Cafe, but as some members of the group are disabled or not so mobile, not all of them can join. A 68-year-old retired dental nurse, part of the over-60s group, who wished to remain anonymous, said, "I have Parkinson's disease and it's very difficult to get upstairs. I go to the cafe every week with the club, but it's difficult to climb the stairs. My husband helps me, but if the lift was working, I would use that. I'm very upset that the lift has been broken for so long, especially for the people who run the cafe. They are the reason why we go there, really. They're a lovely couple and they work so hard." The over-60s club had planned for all 28 members to go to the cafe for a Christmas meal, but due to the broken lift, the plans cannot go ahead. Mrs. Portlock said, "We were going to meet there for our Christmas meal, but we can't go because some of our group can't get up the stairs. When I told the owner of the cafe we wouldn't be able to do the meal, he had tears in his eyes. He looked so upset." Both Mrs. Portlock and her 68-year-old friend shared concerns about people with prams and buggies. The retired dental nurse said, "It worries me also because there are ladies with babies who go to the sessions upstairs in the building, and they all have to leave their prams downstairs. Prams are very expensive and it worries me that someone might pinch them." A spokesperson for Charwell District Council said, "Ensuring the lift returns to full working order is important, which is why our team have been working hard to address this. Due to the nature of the fault, there has been some difficulty identifying the source and being able to get the right parts and specialist engineers to repair this. We are pleased that repairs will be taking place soon and the upper floor will be accessible to visitors with limited mobility."
To celebrate the 400th anniversary of the Oxford Botanic Garden, the Oxford Artisan Distillery is set to launch a limited edition whisky inspired by J.R.R. Tolkien. Black Pine Whisky will be released to celebrate Hobbit Day, which takes place every year on September the 22nd. The rye whisky, inspired by Tolkien's pine, comes with either a limited edition box or coaster created from wood of the legendary black pine, which grew in the Botanic Garden for nearly 200 years and is best known for its association with J.R.R. Tolkien. The iconic black pine, Pinus nigra, likely planted in the early 1830s, met a tragic end in 2014 when it shed two massive branches and needed to be felled. The pine was reportedly the favourite tree of Tolkien and was often referred to as Tolkien's pine. The black pine is also unmistakably present at the end of Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials trilogy, when its heroine, Lyra, sits underneath this famous tree. The rye whiskey has been distilled from the heritage grains grown exclusively for the distillery, mostly within 50 miles of Oxford. Renowned Oxford illustrator Stanley Donwood has created an illustration of the original black pine for the label. Since 1994, he has created all the artwork for the rock band Radiohead with singer Tom York. Oxford-based letterpress printer Richard Lawrence, known for his collaborations with artists and designers to create highly distinctive work, has printed the label and accompanying booklet. The wood of the black pine was crafted into commemorative boxes by Silver Foundation's Wood School. Simon Hiscock, director of the Oxford Botanic Garden and Arboretum, said, "We're delighted to be partnering with the Oxford Artisan Distillery on this unique project to celebrate our anniversary and the legendary black pine, which was an iconic feature of the garden for so many years. We're excited to be launching this limited edition whisky along with unique boxes and coasters crafted from wood of the black pine, better known as Tolkien's pine. It was important to us that the project included local artisans and craftspeople, and we have worked hard to create the ideal whisky gift to remember this famous tree in our 400th anniversary celebrations.
A master plan for a 1,250 home development to the north of Witney has been released. A proposal for the major housing development has been published online by the North Witney Consortium, with people encouraged to provide feedback. The plans have not yet been submitted to the Planning Authority, West Oxfordshire District Council. In its current form, the proposed development would see houses built off Hayley Road, Middlefield Farm, New Yatt Road, Woodstock Road, and near the King's School. There would also be a new primary school, community and retail centre, and public green spaces. A virtual public exhibition will be open for comments from September the 28th to October the 19th. There will be two in-person events held in the canteen at Witney Community Primary School on October the 7th, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. and October the 11th, 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. For more information, visit https://northwitney.co.uk/.
Two clinicians working in Oxford trekked 26 miles alongside 368 fellow walkers, including broadcasting legend Jeff Stelling, for prostate cancer. Dr. Philip Camilleri and Dr. Nicola Dallas, Genesic Care clinicians based in Oxford, walked from Wembley Stadium to Wickham Wanderers Adams Park on Sunday, September the 17th, in aid of prostate cancer UK. The walk raised over £210,000 for the charity. The money raised from the walk, organised in honour of TB presenter Bill Turnbull, who died from the disease last year, will help improve the lives of men affected by prostate cancer. Dr. Camilleri specialises in urological cancers, specifically prostate, bladder, renal and testicular cancers. Dr. Dallas has a special interest in technical radiotherapy and introduced the use of intensity-modulated radiotherapy and now dynamic ARC intensive-modulated radiotherapy for the treatment of head and neck cancers at the Genesis Care Oxford Centre. Both clinicians work at Genesis Care, a private cancer care provider and headline sponsor of Prostate Cancer UK's football march, to provide patients access to the latest groundbreaking treatment and individualised treatment pathways with fewer side effects.
It was a world-famous shoe shop, visited by the likes of Jeremy Clarkson, Rowan Atkinson and J.R.R. Tolkien. For Bob and Isabel Avery, who ran Ducker and Son, Oxford's world-famous shoe shop, it proved to be a long goodbye at the start of 2017. The couple featured signs in the window of their iconic store at 6 Turl Street, informing loyal customers that they were shutting up the shop for good for months. We took a dip through our archives to remember the loss of a popular store. Since the store opened in 1898, Ducker's had been synonymous with the art of shoemaking. But by 2017, bespoke Oxford brogues were no longer for sale. The Averys were unable to find a suitable buyer to take over the lease, and the shop closed for the last time at the end of February 2017. The store's historic ledgers, fixtures and fittings were removed, but so many loyal customers continued knocking on the door to thank the Averys that they didn't have the heart to take down the sign over the door for months before the official closure. Historic ledgers revealed the shoe buying habits of famous names over the years, including the author J.R.R. Tolkien, and they were handed to auctioneers Malams. Father of four, Bob Avery, 71, a former pupil of Cowley St. John Boys School, said at the time, "I started out in shoe repairs for Woolworths in Cornmarket in 1968, and I began working here full-time in 1990. When we retire, I won't have to get up at 5 a.m. to start in the workshop." The problem with a shop like this is that in a sense you stand still in time. It's very traditional and has an old-fashioned ethic. Customers are greeted as sir or madam, and we thank them for their custom when they go out of the door. We are like the dinosaurs of the high street because we are the only ones left. Mr. Avery said he and his wife took over the shop in 1990, and they brightened the place up and succeeded in giving it an air of prosperity. It's ironic we're closing now, because we're closing at the top of our business.
A pub has repainted its sign after villagers complained the design was confusing. Eagle-eyed folk said the newly painted lettering outside the Crown in Marcham looked more like the Crowd because of its Saxon-style font. The response prompted the pub's owner, Oak Taverns, to replace it with a new design. One villager, who lives 2 minutes away from the pub, said the repainted sign had been a talking point in Marcham. The man, who did not wish to be named, said the sign was scrubbed off and repainted. I did wonder why they had to repaint it completely, as the new sign looks very similar to the first attempt. Maybe they could just have embraced the Crowd as a name, as there are so many pubs called the Crown. Pardon the pun, but it could have stood out from the crowd. Simon Collinson, director of the pub company, said he spoke with his sign writer last week and they agreed that clearer lettering was needed. He said, "We had wanted to go for something quite traditional, but also a bit different. But we looked at it and saw the comments on social media, and we decided to make it slightly less Saxon and slightly more social media friendly." Villagers had voiced concern over the original sign when images were shared on Facebook. "The crowd looks great," joked Shelley Newton, while Ellie Wright added, "It does look a bit like crowd, now you mention it." But Elizabeth O'Donnell said it was a massive improvement on how it looked before, and that you can't please all of the people all the time. Kevin Watkins added that he was happy as long as the Guinness tap works. Another householder, who didn't wish to be named, said she didn't care what the pub was called. "It just makes such a difference to a village to actually have a pub open. So as long as it serves food and drink, then it can be called whatever it wants, really," she added. The Crown has been closed since the summer of 2022, but has undergone a major refurbishment since it was taken over by Oak Taverns in July this year. It was due to open its doors to the public for the first time on Thursday, the 28th of September.
Medieval Oxford's murder rate was 100 times the homicide rate for the entire Thames Valley, new research has suggested. Researchers behind the University of Cambridge's medieval murder map estimate that the murder rate in late medieval Oxford was the equivalent of around 60 to 75 per 100,000. The equivalent rate for modern-day Thames Valley is around 0.7. In the late 14th century, the city was one of Europe's most important centres of learning, home to around 7,000 people, including 1,500 students. An analysis of the 700-year-old coroner's records suggests that it was a fairly bloody place to live. Professor Manuel Eisner, director of the University of Cambridge's Institute of Criminology, said, "A medieval university city such as Oxford had a deadly mix of conditions. Oxford students were all male and typically aged between 14 and 21, the peak for violence and risk-taking. These were young men freed from the tight controls of family, parish or guild and thrust into an environment full of weapons with ample access to alehouses and sex workers." He told the university's Cam Stories website, "As well as clashes between town and gown, many students belonged to regional fraternities called nations, an additional source of conflict within the student body. True crime history buffs can see for themselves Oxford's murderous medieval past. A new interactive map put together by the Cambridge researchers gives people the chance to see where, when and why their medieval forebears were murdered in the city. The stories in the map reveal an easy recourse to violence by students, townspeople and strangers alike. A A brawl at a High Street tavern on a Thursday night in September 1298 ended in the death of Irish clerk John Burrell. When an argument spilled out of the drinking den, Burrell drew his sword before charging at two other clerks. One tried to parry his blows with his own sword, slicing Burrell across his forehead, and his companion, a John de Suthfork, swung a battle axe towards Burrell in an attempt to defend his friend, leaving the Irish clerk with a 6-inch wound to his head. The previous year, 1298, Clerk David of Northampton was said to have been saying his prayers as he walked outside his home on what is now Ship Street. Another man, John Lawrence, shoulder-barged him repeatedly. David asked him to leave him in peace and so returned to his lodging, the coroner recorded. Not content with that, John banged on the front door. The man whose prayers had been interrupted emerged from the house armed with a staff and rained down blows on his head, shoulders and back. John died 15 days later, although not before both men were locked up by the Chancellor of the University's official. The turn of the century failed to stem the violence, the stories recorded in the map suggest. In 1344, 4 years before the Back Death struck, another scholar was hit in the eye with an arrow shot by student Hugh Mims. The bowman fled, whither is not known, the coroner's record said. Mims was a mainpast or servant of the Abbot of Osney Abbey. Women were also among the victims. Sex worker Marjorie de Hereford was murdered in 1299 by a scholar who stabbed her to death rather than pay her what he owed. He was never brought to justice. Even officials responsible for maintaining law and order were not safe. On a summer night in 1324, preserver of the King's Peace, Richard Overth, was beaten and stabbed by 4 students. He was found dead in his home. Professor Eisner said, "Circumstances that frequently led to violence will be familiar to us today, such as young men with group affiliations pursuing sex and alcohol during periods of leisure at the weekends. Weapons were never far away and male honour had to be protected." But he added, "Life in medieval urban centres could be rough, but it was by no means lawless. The community understood their rights and used the law when conflicts emerged. Each case provides a glimpse of the dynamics that created a burst of violence on a street in England some 7 centuries ago."
Harry Potter star Emma Watson is coming back to the University of Oxford, it's been reported. The actress, who spent a year studying at Worcester College while an undergraduate, has signed up for a master's degree in creative writing. Most of the course will be completed online, although she will be expected to study at Oxford on a handful of dates. A source told The Sun, "The course is for older adults and can be done on a part-time basis, which is perfect for Emma's schedule. She only has to be on site for 4 or 5 days a year because she can do the rest of the course online from home." They added, "Because she's a famous actress, she'll have a security team looking after her whenever she has classes to go to. There have been a few incidents recently, and she is taking every precaution necessary to ensure her safety." Ms. Watson first revealed her plans to enrol on the creative writing course in an interview with the Financial Times earlier this year. She said she began writing poetry during lockdown, along with essays on love and friendships. The actress, who made her name as Hermione Granger in the Harry Potter series, was a pupil at the Dragon School and Headington School in the city.
A petition has been launched in support of local businesses affected by the closure of the Botley Road in Oxford. Network Rail, with the permission of the County Council, closed Botley Road at the rail bridge in April as part of a £161 million upgrade of Oxford Rail Station. The Rail Authority promised traders it would reopen Botley Road at the end of October for 4 months and then start work again, finishing the scheme in October 2024. But earlier this month, rail bosses announced that complications with the scheme, including the discovery of an underground Victorian arch, mean that the project is going to take longer and now there will be no break in the schedule. Julian LaVey, who runs local campaign group West Oxford Access, said some businesses might not survive and is campaigning for them to get compensation. After launching an online petition in support of businesses, Mr. LaVey said, "Several local businesses say that the postponement of reopening of Botley Road, planned for next month for a further full year, is more than they can withstand. On top of losses to date, the unending changes in Network Rail's plans, always at the very last moment, make it impossible for businesses to plan how to cope. No one supposes that the latest plan will work either. It seems very wrong that hard-working shop owners should be bankrupted by the serial incompetence of Network Rail. And we as a community stand to lose valued local businesses. So we've launched a petition on behalf of the community, asking the government, whose creature Network Rail is, to give temporary financial support to businesses as it did during COVID. Or failing that, the councils, both of them, which had a hand in approving this project. The £161 million scheme includes the creation of a new western entrance to the station, the replacement of the rail bridge and creation of new walkways and cycle routes around it. Dale Crutcher, Network Rail's Industry Programme Director for the Greater Oxford Area, said, "This project is extremely complex and has been made even more challenging by the extent of the brick arch underneath the road. We've done everything we can to deliver the work, including moving to working around the clock. But unfortunately, with needing the infrastructure to be ready by the end of next year, we have no choice but to keep the road closed until October 2024. The petition, which so far has 148 signatures, says, "In addition to huge inconvenience to many people, local businesses are paying the price as trade is strangled. Network Rail's constant changes of plan, always at the last moment, make it impossible to cope. Several family businesses valued by the community say that they doubt they can survive. We demand the government, as the owner of Network Rail, compensates businesses for their losses. Or failing that, the city and county councils, both of which gave their go-ahead or supported the project on the basis of a four-day closure. It is morally wrong that people should lose their livelihood and the community should lose its shops." Network Rail spokeswoman Emily Maiden said, "Every business is unique and the support we can offer businesses will need to be tailored to their needs. We would encourage any affected businesses to contact us via Oxford Phase 2 at networkrail.co.uk or by going to networkrail.co.uk/contact us. To sign the change.org petition, visit https://chng.it/QQJ2SNQ4H.
People have vented their fury over plans for a gargantuan solar farm, which an Oxfordshire MP says will lead to the permanent industrialisation of the Green Belt. Cumnor Parish Council invited Oxford West and Abingdon MP Leila Moran to speak at a packed community meeting attended by 130 people and campaign group Stop Botley West. The 1,000 hectare, that's 2,471 acre, solar farm could span three sites, west of Botley, west of Kidlington and north of Woodstock. More than 75% of it would be on Oxford's Green Belt. Villagers voiced their concerns that the current information available to them indicates that 51 miles of 8-foot-high animal-proof security fencing, CCTV cameras and motion-activated IR lights will surround over 150-plus Green Belt fields. Ms. Moran said, "I absolutely understand the frustration and anger felt by local people. Residents are telling me that they are worried about the flood risk, the loss of good agricultural land, and the impact on ecologically important wildlife sites that sit next to the proposed sites. They also question the need for such a large-scale power station, which will lead to the permanent industrialisation of the Green Belt. A final decision on the scheme will be made by the Planning Inspectorate and the Secretary of State. If the solar farm gets the go-ahead from the Secretary of State, building is expected to start in the summer of 2025.
An animal rescue centre near the Oxfordshire border has issued an urgent appeal for help after an explosion of kittens have arrived in the shelter. So far this year, staff at Cotswolds Dogs and Cats Home near Dursley have helped 92 cats, which is a 34% increase from the last year. A spokeswoman has described the current situation as heartbreaking and has revealed that the shelter is currently full to capacity and dealing with an unprecedented waiting list. They have blamed the cause on the cost of living crisis, as animals are arriving at a much larger rate than they can be rehomed. Meanwhile, the centre says it is also experiencing the fallout from an increase in cats not being neutered. It has now launched an urgent fundraising appeal to help cover the cost of caring for the animals. A spokeswoman said, "We are currently full to capacity and with an unprecedented waiting list. Sadly, this means we are having to make extremely hard decisions about which animals to rehome. On average, each animal that arrives at our centre costs around £372 in medical bills alone. An increase in unneutered cats has sadly seen a more significant number of unwanted litters, combined with kittens purchased during the lockdown, with families now no longer being able to care for them, leaving us with a real catastrophe. It's heartbreaking to see so many unwanted cats and kittens. While the CDCH continues to do everything we can to take in as many as we can from some of these situations to help them find the perfect home, it is becoming a serious challenge. On top of the increase in cats and kitten intake due to the cost of living crisis, rehoming has slowed down, leaving us in a position where we have more cats in need coming in faster than we can find homes for them. We urgently need your help to cover the costs involved in getting these kittens and cats neutered, microchipped, vaccinated, and available for adoption. You can donate to the appeal here. TinyURL, that is tinyurl.com/3EC7JK34.
A 1937 George VI coin set sold for £9,200 to an online bidder at an auction in Oxford Library recently. Supplied with its original case, the gold specimen four-coin set by the Royal Mint was the top-selling lot at the Mallam's September the 20th sale. Other popular items at the Oxford Library sale included an antique German-carved lindenwood and polychrome figure of St George slaying the dragon, and 18 works by the British portrait painter Jane Bond. Mallam's sales specialist Duncan Lloyd said, "It was a good mixed sale with some strong results and with objects of rarity attracting the most interest." Books featured prominently in the sale, and a 10-volume set entitled The Naturalist's Library Ornithology, circa 1800, was snapped up by an online bidder for £620, more than double its conservative estimated value. A first edition of Ian Fleming's Goldfinger from 1959 by Jonathan Cape and Gildrose Products fetched the same price. Mallam's Oxford is now inviting entries for its November jewellery, silver and watches sale, its December design plus modern art sale, and its next Oxford Library sale in February 2024. Anyone considering selling items at auction can email oxford@mallams.co.uk for a free informal valuation. All prices are subject to a 30% buyer's premium, VAT inclusive.
A school has reopened after closing early last Wednesday after an incident broke out, with staff and pupils leaving hours ahead of the bell ringing. The Oxford Academy was forced to send pupils home early, with a spokesperson confirming a small group of boys had decided to push back against recent changes introduced for behaviour regulation. An open evening that was scheduled for after the school day was also cancelled as a result. It is believed that the students were asked to leave school between the hours of 10 a.m. and 11 a.m. A spokesman for the school, which is part of the River Learning Trust, said, "Over the last few years, we have significantly improved behaviour and are creating an environment in which students behave well, are happy and are able to flourish. This process is ongoing, and to allow the school to continue its journey of improvement, there have been further recent changes relating to behaviour and high expectations of students. These changes have been welcomed by the majority of students, families and staff. A small section of the student body has decided that it wants to push back against the changes. This led to students displaying behaviour today similar to that seen on social media in other UK schools earlier in the year, when some students join in staged, artificial and disruptive events. There is certainly not significant opposition amongst students to the Oxford Academy being a school that aims to serve its community and give its young people great life chances. We don't apologise for having high expectations of our students. We know that this is the right thing to do." The spokesman for the school refused to comment on whether any disciplinary action had been taken. It is understood that no weapons were used during the incident, despite speculation on social media. Katie Healy, whose best friend's niece attends the school, said, "My friend was quite panicked and she was very upset and sad by what had happened. She lives about 2 minutes away and literally ran to the school when she found out. It's very bad. Her niece was crying and very scared. A lot of people are saying that they will not be sending their kids back there again. The school had to be shut and students sent home. They were meant to be having an open event in the evening, but have had to cancel it due to how unsafe it is." A Thames Valley Police spokesman added that the matter is not being treated as a police incident. The Oxford Academy is located in Sandy Lane West in Littlemore.
A new glass artwork memorial dedicated to organ donors has been unveiled at the John Radcliffe Hospital. The Gift of Life, designed by glass artist Martin Donlin, was revealed recently as part of Organ Donation Week at the Headington site. The colourful memorial extends along one facade of glass and aims to recognise the contribution of organ and tissue donors, particularly from Oxfordshire. A specialist nurse in organ donation, SNOD, S-N-O-D, Candice Hines, said, "We are proud to be paying tribute to the past and future organ and tissue donors and their families who have made the Gift of Life possible. The family member of a deceased donor and a donor recipient watched on as the memorial was unveiled, alongside the Deputy Lord Mayor of Oxford and a few other attendees. Artist Martin Donlin cited renewal and regeneration as inspiration for the design, represented by abstracted images of forget-me-not flowers. He added, "Bright, vibrant colours are overlaid with subtle, delicate lines integrated with the skyline of Oxford. The text, The Gift of Life, runs throughout the entire design as a message to us all of the importance of organ donation." Installation of the design was funded by the Organ Donation Committee with support from Oxford Hospital's charity. It was developed by ArtLink, the arts programme for Oxford University Hospitals. The ribbon was cut by Sarah Cameron and Teresa Saunders, for whom the memorial carried a special personal significance. Ms. Cameron's father, who signed up to be an organ donor before his death after he was diagnosed with a rare type of stroke, had had his kidneys subsequently donated to two patients in need. She said, "As a donor family, it's fantastic to see the sacrifice of so many recognised in a beautiful installation. We hope it will increase awareness of organ donation and encourage honest conversations between family, friends and staff. Ms. Saunders, who was the recipient of life-changing transplants in 2013, said, "I am here today because an angel saved me from living a short life, and I am honoured to be here with my family for a lot longer." The John Radcliffe Hospital falls under the umbrella of the Oxford University Hospitals NHS Foundation Trust, which employs more than 12,000 staff and consists of four Oxfordshire hospitals. The Trust supports world-leading research programmes and works in close partnership with the University of Oxford to combine academic research expertise with clinical teams. Visit the NHS Blood and Transplant website to register your decision about organ donation.
Oisin Smith believes that last season's managerial change at Oxford United came at the right time for his progression at the club. The midfielder joined United from Dungannon Swifts on January deadline day last year, while Carl Robinson was in charge of the Ewes. However, he did not make his league debut until after Robinson was sacked. Caretaker boss Craig Short introduced Smith for the injured James Henry during the 3-2 loss at home to Derby County in March, before Liam Manning then handed Smith his first league start in the 1-1 draw at Morecambe, Manning's first game as a United head coach. Prior to these appearances, Smith had been limited to just two games in a Ewes shirt, both as a substitute. The 23-year-old midfielder endured a difficult start to life at United, with opportunities away from the club also proving difficult to come by. He injured his hamstring just as he was about to head out on loan to an unnamed Vanarama National League side back in October, before a trial at Sky Bet League 2 club in December saw no loan deal struck. Smith then made three appearances for National League side Solihull Moors during a loan spell in January. Although his presence in the Ewes matchday squad is more settled now, he remained confident he would get his chances when he was not in the picture. He said, "Since the gaffer came in, I felt more part of it, and although we've added the depth, the opportunity is still there for minutes. I just want to push on and get more. In terms of how I train and apply myself, I always thought I was going to get minutes eventually. It came to a bit of a standstill at one stage, and I did need that change. It came at the right time for me." The Northern Irish midfielder added, "I don't think you've seen much from me yet. There's still a lot more to come. I'm working hard to try and get in the team and show what I can do. I can guarantee when I get my chance, I'll take it." Smith believes that Manning's style of play and the variation in skill sets that the midfield department possesses is to his advantage. He said, "The way the gaffer likes to play with two holding midfielders, it suits me down to the ground and gives me a better chance of breaking in. With the two sixes and who I'm playing with, I think I have that versatility to play that bit further forward or a bit deeper. I like that freedom to go and join the attack, but at the same time dropping in and getting on the ball. The one thing we touch on all the time is the difference we have in there and the different types of players we bring when one of us comes in and one of us comes out. It gives the opposition something to think about. In terms of what we do, you never like to play with someone who's quite similar, so it gives us that versatility in there as well." Smith added, "We knew that coming into this year, the gaffer wanted that depth, and that's what we've seen. We've seen a lot of squad rotation, but the performances have been there, and when you're winning, you can't really complain."
Tourists and shoppers were greeted by the sound of tinkling bicycle bells as youngsters took part in a massed ride through Oxford city streets. The Kiddical Mass Ride saw around 100 youngsters and their parents descend on Broad Street one Sunday before cycling a circular route past the Museum of Natural History and down St Giles. Johnny Ives of Cyclox, the campaign group organising the ride, said, "What's great with the kids, I think, is their enthusiasm to be on a bike. It starts and ends with that, really. When you've got safe spaces to ride a bike with your children and you're concerned for your little ones, who are a bit more unpredictable, your anxiety drops. A concept imported from the United States, kidical mass rides for children have been organised in towns and cities around the UK by campaigners keen to promote cycling and road safety.
That was the last of our articles for this week. If you have any comments or feedback about Oxtalk, you can telephone Margaret on 07496 062280. That's 07496 062280. Please remember to leave your name and contact number with your message. Alternatively, you can send an email to mail@oxtalk.org.uk. This edition and those from previous weeks are available on our website at www.oxtalk.org.uk, where you can either listen directly or download the audio file. You can also listen on an Alexa device through the Talking Newspapers skill. If you need advice on this, please phone the main Oxtalk number. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with more news, so until then, we hope you have a good week.